early to bed, early to rise, eat right and advertise. Early to bed, early to rise. And one more thing, get your name out there.
Welcome to Paleo Ad Tech, a podcast about the first two decades of advertising technology. I'm Marty Kine, and this week I'm delighted to welcome Joseph Zito to the show. Joseph started in marketing tech at Experian and later joined Datalogix, where he worked for Eric Rosa, the man who owns the only cult I personally belong to, which is CrossFit. Joseph was at Datalogix during a period of rapid growth and five or six acquisitions. At its peak, the company had more than 80% of the top US advertisers and 7/8 of the top publishers as customers, which is a lot of customers. DLX, as it's known in the business, was acquired by Oracle in 2014 and became part of the Oracle Data Cloud. Today, Joseph runs Xform Coaching and Consulting, and he's based in and around the New York City area. How did you end up at Datalogix? How did that leap happen?
There was an executive search, and she'd said, hey, there's this company you really need to talk to. And I'd said, yeah, I'm not really interested, but I'll go connect with them. I met with them. I found out what they were doing. I was blown away by the asset that they had created, the product that they had built with it, the problems they were solving, and the quality of the people that were there. And couldn't say no.
What was the year that this conversation happened?
Like, I think around 2012.
And did you talk to Eric Rosa at the time?
Yeah, the later stages, primarily Chris Scoggins, who's currently a Signalfire, was the president of the company, I think was his title, initially. And then Rosa, you know, he gave me a call in the final stages. I was really kind of on the fence, and he did the silver bullet call, as we called it, to see what would get me over the line. And certainly impressed with that conversation. And indeed, he did close me.
And how many burpees did he make you do?
None, thank God, in that that certainly would have turned me the other way. Although in later stages of our time together, we would have our weekly one-to-one meetings, or we had some of our one-to-ones in the CrossFit gym. And I distinctly remember talking about commercial and contracting strategies as he was helping me with my form on what do you call them, kipping pull-ups, right?
Oh, yeah.
And it was great, right?
Yeah, form is critical in those types of environments.
Come on, buddy, pull up. Pull up, Cougar.
So I was at Digitas on the agency side in this time period, and we knew I was exposed to Datalogix as kind of a measurement solution. So it was an elegant way to tie online impressions with offline purchases. So it was sort of like closing the loop, and that was difficult to do.
Yeah.
But I know that Datalogix, if we look at the history of Datalogix, it's gone through a number of different iterations. It had a bunch of different product lines over the years, and that was just one of them. So it started, though, as I understand it, in the direct mail space. Isn't that right? Like with catalogs and
indeed,
the post
very
office.
Few people know.
Yes.
Correct. Yes. Very few people know that Datalogix was initially a company called Next Action, which was a direct mail cooperative. It's a long-standing framework that many in the ad tech space aren't familiar with, but does very much for direct mailers and brands at large what it is that Datalogix did in the digital world. So it was a natural progression.
How does that work? Because I know DoubleClick tried to acquire a company called, or actually did acquire a company called Abacus, and then sold it off again later.
Right.
It was in a similar space. So how do those direct mail cooperatives work exactly?
Well, the direct mail cooperative itself was an evolution of a model when it came to direct mail strategy. So if you think of the Williams-Sonomas of the world, you have loyalty programs, et cetera, and they've got their own CRM file. What they'd realized was they could sell the ability to target their customers to non-competitive companies. You know, we have these segments of people. We will send that to the mail merge company. You will send your catalogs or your direct mail piece out to them. And you can mail them without ever knowing who they are, unless they end up converting and buying from you. And so it was a way by which one company could leverage data from another to market directly to people that weren't their current customers, and yet without breaking the anonymity of those customers. And then that evolved to, all right, well, instead of Williamson almost selling them one by one, you had list brokers and they would bring all the lists together. And then you had predictive modeling coming into place. And so what would happen was the direct mail cooperative was, rather than the list broker selling a number of individual lists, all of them would be brought together in aggregate, and predictive modeling could be used to build segments to ensure with a number of rules that those contributing to the cooperative were not having their data targeted by competitive companies.
Right.
And that was the data cooperative. It was the place in which a breadth of SKU level transactional data at the individual level with name and address was held, anonymized, aggregated, obfuscated, all of that stuff. And this has been going on for decades, right? Before any of the existing consumer data concerns have surfaced to the forefront. It's going on for quite some time.
We had actually one of our early guests was Beth Wallace, who worked at AOL, and she came out of the print space, and she knew about these cooperatives. And she said, in fact, in the past, in the 90s, there was much more detailed information about household, at least at the household level, being bought and sold behind the scenes. And people didn't seem to worry about it. It was only when it was attached to a cookie, which was completely anonymous, the people who came upset.
And so what Datalogix, if you think about it, the natural progression then was Eric came into Next Action, Chris, who was connected to them from venture funding, came on and brought in a number of really great people to, if you think about the kind of middle piece that was creating the obfuscation and the ability to keep the individuals that you were, the consumers that you were messaging from the advertising brand was the mail merge. We'll just replace that with a cookie. And instead you're sending segments, you know, out to the cookie and then you're connecting them that way. And and that was the digital transformation. So early on we had a number of match partners.
Yeah.
So if you think about any website with a registration where you have your email address and you log in. And so we would simply work with them. We would pay them on thousands, X cents per dollars per thousand to do something very simple, which is say, we would make a connection and it would say, hey, this email address, josephzito@whatever.com. Do you have him a cookie yet? No. Okay, great. Here's the cookie. Bang. That's it. There was no first name, last name, PII, anything shared.
Sure.
Yeah. All we did was pay them to make a connection. And then that was the way by which we could deliver the anonymized segmentation or anonymized consumers within a segment based on transactional data and the digital one out.
So the first version then of Datalogix, so the version I described was the measurement piece. So that was closing the loop offline.
There you go.
But before that came along, there was this other version of Datalogix, which I guess never went away, but it was about delivering segmentation. So when you were hired into Datalogix, what was the product that they were selling or you guys were selling?
There were, I'll say, you know, probably three core products. So the first was what called Pure Play CRM onboarding, which LiveRamp is known for, right?
Sure.
And so if we had these, I'll just continue to use Williams-Sonoma as an archetypical partner. Not, again,
theoretical.
Theoretical. And so it made sense to say, hey, we're doing a great deal of predictive modeling for you on who your best people are, they're likely to attract, or et cetera. And let's also just bring them online and you can target them in two channels rather than in one. So that was CRM onboarding. That was the first, we call that a DLX on-ramp. But then naturally there was the third-party segmentation, which took two forms. One, there were pre-built off-the-shelf segments that would create. So the same way that there were age and gender, standard demographics that you might see in any DSP at the time, we would create them based on purchase data. And so there are these third-party segments, or we could create lookalikes of your first party using the third-party data and say, here's the breadth of data that we have and all the people that purchase just like those people. So the you know, early on, the core value prop of the third party data was the best predictor of a future purchase is a breadth of past purchases, not past clicking. We all know that the 16-year-old that goes to... it was the best proxy, and there was a lot of waste there. And
sure.
There's some 16-year-old going on the Ferrari site because he loves Ferraris, and the next thing you know, like, he's getting all these ads, right?
And there are natural-born clickers, apparently, people who just like to click ads, out of who knows why.
There you go. And then the third product was, as you mentioned, if we were bringing the offline data online to be able to message to them, that linkage was there. Could we go back and create a way to see if they were exposed, if they purchased afterwards? And that was transformative for us in a number of ways. And that was really what brought me to Datalogix. I had at Experian a number of clients that was what they were trying to solve. And a couple of companies out there that were providing coupons and in your email or in your whatever, and the amount of linkage and the just wasn't there. And so to be able to say, especially for brand advertisers, not direct response marketers. So now you take the Williams-Sonomas out of it and you get to the Procter & Gamble's and the Conagra's. How much Lunchables are we selling? Or how many cars are actually moving off the lot from this advertising? That was game changing.
Well, it's extraordinary. I mean, because digital was always measured by proxy. It was clicks. It was even sort of view through. And then we had attribution models, but none of it was measuring offline purchase. And a lot of these ads, like car ads, you had to go into the car dealership and do a test drive and then buy the car. And the advertiser had no idea if that transaction actually happened. I mean, you could do some kind of geographic modeling and so on. But so what the value proposition Datalogix offered, and that's why it became so popular, was amazing. I do have to ask you, though, people are wonder where did the purchase data come from? Like, what was the source?
It was that cooperative model, right? Mm-hmm. And so if you think about it, you have, call it, over 1,000 different retailers providing you with the breadth of their CRM file on a monthly or biweekly or sometimes nightly basis.
Okay.
For them to get the benefits of using the breadth of the other, the combined amount of data there. That was, the great chunk of it at first. Later on, we bought a company called Spire that did that with just grocery stores. And then in automotive, we partnered with Polk. We had an exclusive Polk Automotive who, for 80 years had been the go-to for automotive transactional data. And they'd only worked in the offline spaces and et cetera. They'd never had a play to get into digital. So we just said, let's be your go-to to make that happen.
And then before you acquired Spire, there was another partner?
In terms of sourcing data, certainly. There were the Kantars of the world that we might license at first. Mm-hmm. There was, it's very interesting. You and I have spoken previously. There are probably two or three events that I can think of that I look at and I say, yeah, Datalogix shouldn't have existed after this point.
Near-death experiences?
It would have killed most companies. And so, we were leveraging like Kantar, maybe licensing data from a couple retailers. And then a woman named Karina Seleniks, she owned what I will say is one of the largest retailers in the world, the holy grail of consumer purchase data. And they were a client of ours, and it became a barter of sorts. They would give us all of their data and we would do all this work for them. And so we suddenly had the holy grail of data at almost no cost. And so we were removing the Kantars of the world and et cetera, and had all of our eggs in this golden basket. And then, somebody from the outside came in, they said, oh my God, you're giving away all this great data, and things changed. And we suddenly had in CPG, which at the time we had three verticals, retail, CPG, and automotive, was perhaps our fastest growing.
Sure.
Right, the fastest horse in the race, our core set of data was gone. And so we said, this is the future of our business.
So this partner pulled out, we'll say.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. And so where do we look? And what do you do in that instance?
What was the staff meeting like that week? Quiet?
Yeah. One of the things I always loved about Datalogix was when these sorts of, call it, disasters. Yeah. There was a hustle. One of our values was we are energized by challenge and change. And we lived that out. I mean, this challenge that would come at you, and there was, the oh shit, what do we do? And then the, right, what do we do? And let's mm-hmm. do it. Right, what do we do? Well, who else might have this? Go buy a company. Great. What would that take? Bang, you've got it. And so those kinds of stabbed me, that or the Cambridge Analytica thing, right? When that happened with Facebook, which oddly was more about Facebook giving their data to a third party rather than us giving, or anybody giving data to Facebook. You know, Cheryl calls up Rosa, and you know, the week before we're submitting our annual budget to Oracle at this point, and says, hey, just the PR from this thing is too much. We're going to have to cut off data. And like, you know, Facebook was maybe 2/3 or half of our revenue. And what do you do? Right. And so you figure it out. Yep. You figure it out.
I hear you. So Spire, then you owned a source of data. What kind of data was that?
That would be consumer package data, rather than okay. call it the retail data of multi-channel retail.
Yeah. So how did you guys do your pricing? Percent of media?
Yep. Yeah, so it varied, right? So yeah. A significant portion of our revenue came through DSPs, which that would be, you know, like CPM, and that would just sit in the platform. But when ad networks were still around, maybe there are one or two of them, that would be percent of that. There was less transparency there. We did some that were monthly data licenses. CRM onboarding was a different cost than, let's say, third-party data. Yeah. They're both CPM, but one was higher or lower. And then the reports, the what you called referred to as closed loop, yeah. They would come. They were priced based on the reports. You could buy a package of them, or just one off, etc.
How frequent was the reporting, by the way?
Yeah, it would be typically campaign end. It would be a campaign. Okay. It would happen, you know, after the campaign ended. It was not like a multi-touch attribution or something like that. That was a platform and it was getting updated in real time. And there was, you know, really a number of reasons for that. You needed a statistical great breadth of exposure and conversion data, and you wanted to make sure you were capturing purchases that happened. People might see the ad today and not buy a car for 30 days or not buy the Lunchables until they have to go back to the store in 2 weeks.
And you mentioned earlier, just to dot the I there, is it was some retail, that's kind of retail cooperative, the data came from them, and it was their CRM data, but specifically right. from loyalty programs, right? That's where they got the
where
they tied the PII to the purchase. Yeah,
correct.
Because otherwise, they wouldn't have visibility into who bought necessarily.
Correct. Correct.
Gotcha.
Correct.
And I know there was actually a very well known and well publicized deal that Datalogix had with Facebook to measure the impact of ads on Facebook. Yeah. It was it actually, you know, got a lot of attention at the time. How did that come about, that particular deal?
We were very much focused on the third party segmentation. You could build them, drop them in a DSP, and we would get a paycheck. It was this sort of flywheel. Whereas the ROI reports felt like a heavier lift, and they weren't always on. And so the question was, you know, do we want to build a product of this nature? And you know, there was some internal debate. But here's what happens when Facebook has, I believe at the time it was General Motors, saying advertising on Facebook doesn't drive actual sales. We can't prove it. You get the thumbs up, the like, and that's fine. But we need to be able to prove that it's driving sales, and so we're not going to advertise with Facebook anymore. And this happened just after they launched the monetization, right? That's an existential threat to Facebook. And they, you know,
General Motors. I remember that they cut off Facebook ads. They're like, well, right. we don't know if these work.
Right, exactly. So who's next? Procter & Gamble, and everybody falls, right? You know, and so existential threat to Facebook, and somebody that had worked, I believe, at Datalogix was over at Facebook and said, hey, I think my former company could solve this. And you know, when one of the biggest players in your ecosystem says, we have an existential threat to our business, can you help us solve it? And you're kind of debating whether you should or you shouldn't. The answer is yes, right? It has to be. And so what we did initially was a meta study. And so instead of working advertiser by advertiser, we would look at, I think we looked at it first, maybe like 100 campaigns that had already run. So they had all the exposure data, and we had to create a very special clean room because, again, they were not even going to give us the exposure data, right? Mm-hmm. So we had to create a very special kind of middle ground that would allow us to run these experiments. And we found over this 100 studies that advertising on Facebook, it did work. For every dollar spent, on average, $3 and change were made back incrementally. And that was game-changing for them. And so what happened next was, before Twitter went to IPO, they needed to prove out the effectiveness. And we did the same thing with them. So it's an incredibly interesting problem to solve. And
new solution. Yeah. And Datalogix ended up being very successful. What was the culture like? I know the main office was somewhere in the middle of Colorado, I think, right?
Yes.
Broomfield, which is data companies in Colorado for some reason.
Yep. Next Action and then Datalogix was located in Broomfield, halfway between Boulder and Denver.
Yeah.
That was, call it the mothership of Datalogix. Scoggins came out to New York and established the New York office. Then after I joined in New York, Scoggins went out West San Francisco with Michelle Holtz, who's currently the head of the chief data officer over the Trade Desk. The two of them worked on those really critical deals with the Facebooks and Twitters and, you know, of the world. Yep. And so we had those offices. We had Chicago, we had Detroit, smaller hubs. But the culture at large, you know, there were subtle differences. I do not use this word with hyperbole. It was magic. I have yet to see it replicated. It was one that was very, very high performing. Everybody that was there was at every level.
Energetic.
Some of the exercising
they were doing too. Did that help?
You saw that everywhere throughout the organization, where these people were not here to mess around. We weren't interested in, we didn't hire people who wanted to come to an office that had like the video games and a kombucha thing on tap. We're just high caliber, high speed, like, let's do this.
But did you guys have kombucha on tap? No.
You know, I know we had beer at one point in Colorado. You would regularly hear that phrase from Rosa at the top in all hands meetings. Okay, well, this is my stay humble, keep improving, which meant I screwed up on this. Like, this was a miss, right? And to hear from the top that phrase in the not just be on the wall, but be spoken out, and to hear Rosa, Scoggins, and all of us saying, okay, that's our code for admitting we screwed up here, right? So you had this high level of talent, ambition, excellence, a high bar for excellence, and all of that, and combined with, okay, we got to stay humble, we have to keep improving.
So at a certain point, you were acquired by Oracle.
Correct.
Big exit. So how did that happen? Was this surprising to you, Joseph?
The big exit was not. Oracle was. Yes, yeah. I certainly was. How it happened comes down to one name, Omar Tawakkol. Actually, let's be clear. There were many names involved, but we were very close to BlueKai. From in a number of ways.
Omar was the founder of BlueKai.
He was the founder of BlueKai, yes. Founder, CEO of BlueKai, and a great gentleman. And so BlueKai had sold over to Oracle and sat within the Oracle marketing cloud. And the legend has it that he'd said to Larry, hey, look, you've got hardware, you have software. The third leg of your stool could be data. And that Larry...
This is Larry Ellison.
Larry Ellison, yes. And so he said, great, let's create a data cloud. Who has the most data, like build me the biggest, best data asset out there. And that when infused with the rest of our product lines, sales cloud, marketing cloud, et cetera, will give us the edge over whoever we're playing against out there. And so, you know, of course, Omar knew us, we were close, and he said, you guys have the biggest data asset out there. And
the rest is history.
The rest is history.
So you became part of the Oracle Data Cloud, and you yourself stayed at Oracle for a bit. What was the impact on your day-to-day life after the Oracle acquisition? Did your role change? Did the company change?
Initially, I owned our ad tech channel. So we had three go-to-markets, retail, automotive, CPG, selling directly to the Best Buys and Conagras and Fords of the world. Yeah. And then my book of business would have been the entire Lumascape, DSPs, DMPs, trading desks, et cetera. And so at time of acquisition, I moved from being over that to heading up the retail business, the general management of the retail practice and business, including the cooperative. And then I had a number of other roles over time, bringing the DMP from the marketing cloud into the data cloud, which was the first SaaS commercial model that we had had, which was, again, Larry Ellison level of engagement, and Mark and Safra as well. In that move, moving an acquisition from marketing cloud to data cloud, we were entirely separate business units. And then the last role that I played there was commercialization, which was, we'd acquired at this point now, I think, five companies post Oracle, maybe including ourselves. And the vision is, you know, 1 + 1 plus one equals 10. And yet customers experience this whole, okay, you're selling us in the vision of moat plus, you know, grape shot, plus
grape
et cetera.
Crosswise.
And crosswise and the DMP and the data, right? The whole, and yet that's one vision. And yet you're giving us like three commercial models, a flat fee, a CPM, and a whatever. You've got four pieces of paper to sign, you have, et cetera. So how do you streamline all of that? How do we do the work, the hard work, to make things easier for our customers? That rarely happens. Story's there, but the integration doesn't happen. And also, how do we launch new products, leveraging the best of all those companies? So Moat Reach would have been an example of that. That was leveraging our offline closed loop product line with Moat's online viewing and attention, and et cetera, bringing that all together into a product. So, and now what changed my day-to-day? The Oracle Data Cloud was an autonomous global business unit. And we maintained all of our own engineers, product people, marketing, et cetera. We shared, you know, legal, finance, HR, those functions. But for the most part, we remained autonomous. So what that means is in some ways, things changed a lot. We could turn around contracts overnight or within a couple of days at Datalogix, at Oracle. Deal velocity, contract velocity decreased significantly. Hiring people and things of that nature. But I was used to that, having been at Experian, right? And so, you know, I want to promote somebody. Well, you can't do it until this cycle. And there's these comp bands and all that. Yeah. People that were pure play startup life had never experienced that. But I had Experian familiarity. And so it wasn't that much of a shock to me. Did I love it? No. Did I know how to work the system? Yes. And so, okay. You're on a new planet. And so you have to acknowledge the physics, the new gravity and work with it, not deny it. So that changed. On the other end, being that we were this autonomous global business unit, we still felt like Datalogix up until just before I left, like 4.5, 5 years later, just a much larger version. Instead of 200 people, it was 2,500 people. And that culture was very much there. A lot of the companies required, Moat and Jonah and those guys, have a very similar culture to Datalogix. And
there was some sympathy.
Yeah, this guy felt like a big startup.
And in Colorado, though, did you change offices?
We did. But, you know, legend has it that part of the deal was Rosa made Oracle agree to, if we're moving into the Oracle campus, you have to build a CrossFit gym there. Because part of the culture we haven't discussed was Rosa had
he owned a CrossFit gym. Yeah.
Well, you had a CrossFit gym, but we also, you know, it was important that if we were going to work hard from a business standpoint, we needed to be personally healthy. Mm-hmm. So we had at one point a CrossFit coach on staff, on payroll at Datalogix, and he would came to our client summits. Coach Dan, I think it was his name, he would be there like leading the stretches after lunch, et cetera.
The Oracle Data Cloud, you mentioned their BlueKai and moving the DMP from Marketing Cloud over to Data Cloud. Mm-hmm. And BlueKai had it was a DMP. It also had kind of a data marketplace. Could you maybe just explain what happened there? Like, why did it move? I've spoken to Omar in the past, and we'll get him on the show, Omar. And he said something about originally the DMP was put under MarTech people who didn't really understand, you know, ad tech very well.
That is perhaps the most tactful way of saying it, you know.
Polite fellow.
Yeah, like I said, a gentleman. A DMP at the time, and what we imagined it to be, what is now a CDP, and at first we were calling it a private data cloud.
Yeah.
Primarily, they can be used across all digital channels, right? Email, et cetera. But it was, let's face it, the primary place it has been used was in advertising. The agencies that exist there that are a crucial part of the ecosystem, you know, they're not there in the email marketing. So there are just different, so many different complexities to the go-to-market, the nuance of how it's being used, the people within the organizations, a different part of the marketing, what matters to them, how they measure things, just vastly different. And then additionally, there was that confusion. Oracle Data Cloud, the Oracle Data Management Platform. And if you're called Abercrombie & Fitch and you have one experience over here that isn't a great one because they don't really speak your language, call it in DMP in the marketing side. And they don't really know. It's always beginning to affect the Data Cloud business because they would say, like, you're all one company. We don't really care if you're two different business units. And you know, so it just made sense to move it over. For a number of reasons. And I understand there was some hesitation. It wasn't easy. And that was, again, having to build a business case and bring that to Larry and Safra and Mark and talk through what that would look like. And it was also a global business unit, right? So I had under me, and when that came under me, we had people in multiple multiple markets globally. And so that was a big move.
So eventually Omar left Oracle. Eric ended up leaving. You stayed, I think, a little longer, but you ended up leaving as well. How did that transition happen, and where did you go next?
Yeah. Once Eric peeled off, for purely personal reasons, he had a lot going on in his personal life, which made all the sense in the world. It had nothing to do with anything that was going on in the category of the business. Yeah. It made sense for me to really think about things. Rob Tarkoff came on. He was great for the brief amount of time that I got to work with him. But Kastora, a company that was backed by General Catalyst, who had also backed Datalogix, was looking for somebody to help them bring the business to the next level. And so that's where I went next. Yeah.
And they were acquired, right, by Amperity?
Amperity, a CDP out of Seattle. CDP. So yeah.
Cool. And then these days, what's keeping Joseph Zito busy?
Executive and business performance, coaching and consulting. So it is, it's variety is the spice of life. And I get to work with a breadth of companies to say, hey, you've got a tens of millions of dollars of problem. It's cross-functional. It's super high impact, and yet you've got a lot of things you don't have figured out, or you may have figured out, but you just need to make sure it gets done. Identify your blind spots and execute, right? The idea is only part of it. It's all in execution.